Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer is Lou Pellegrino. Coming up this week, we have Dana O'Neill. She is a senior writer for The Athletic's The Fieldhouse. That is their college basketball, part of their subscription site, The Athletic subscription site. Dana O'Neill is a name you know from her work as well at ESPN and the Philadelphia Daily News. We are going to get into what it's like to be part of this new enterprise, what kind of college basketball stories she's going to look to do, particularly as we are in the middle of a significant college basketball scandal. And Dana and I talk a little bit about sort of how much you do on that in addition to your regular story. And we also get into what it was like for her to be laid off by ESPN. Absolutely was a surprise for her. And, you know, how she sort of approached taking that news and moving forward. Not easy at all to get laid off from a job that you've been at for a decade and we're doing quality work like Dana O'Neill was. So she gave some interesting thoughts on that. So Dana O'Neill is the guest. She is a senior writer for The Athletic's The Fieldhouse. Let's go to our conversation with Dana O'Neill. Okay, we bring on Dana O'Neill, a senior writer for The Athletic's The Fieldhouse, which is the college basketball part of their subscription site. Dana O'Neill has worked for 25 years as a sports writer, covered multiple Final Fours, Super Bowls, World Series, NBA Finals. Prior to working for The Athletic, she was, of course, at ESPN, and then before that, the Philly Daily News, maybe the Trentonian as well. She'll let me know if I have my research as well. And she is the author of the book Long Shots, which chronicles Villanova's national championship win from a couple years ago. Dana O'Neill, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you for having me, and you have done your research well. There is some truth to the Trentonian rumor.
Why did you decide to join The Athletic?
Well, I mean, obviously in my situation, I was looking for a job, I'll be completely honest, having gotten let go by ESPN. And I told my husband from the get-go that, you know, I wasn't ready to give up my career. I love what I do for a living. I wanted to take one more big swing, and I didn't know where that was going to land me. And I talked to Alex Mather back in May, one of our co-founders, and I hung up with him and I said, I felt like I talked to my fairy godfather of journalism. I just liked his plan. He seemed really smart. I liked the idea of something different. I liked the idea of believing that readers are more interested in reading than we give them credit for. Certainly, I liked the idea of working alongside Seth Davis, who I respect very much. And then down the road, when I heard, you know, Brian Hamilton was getting in line with us too, it was one of those things that I was kind of like, this is kind of fun at this point of my career. Let's try something different. It's a little risky. I get that. But, you know, why not try something that's trying to be forward thinking as opposed to something that's clinging to a model that really isn't doing very well. So it seemed like a no-brainer to me.
How does one get recruited in this sense? Alex Mather is obviously the co-founder of this, but there are editors as well. So does you do have a prominent name, at least in college basketball. So there, people were aware when you were laid off for ESPN that that you might be available. They might not have known what your situation was contractually, mm-hmm. but, you know, they obviously saw that. So did somebody fairly early on reach out to you, or did you reach out? How does it work, basically, in terms of getting recruited?
I have a very weird, bizarre story about how this all happened. So, you know, I'm trying to find a job and figure out what's going to be next. And I am not a patient person. So I was a little panicked pretty much like on day two, like, oh my God, I have to go get a job. So I am trolling through everything. And at one point there was some position for an NHL team, I think. And a friend of mine, Chris Wojcik, works in the NHL offices. I know him through Pete Fammel and Kentucky Derby days, like this random relationship, right? I texted him. I'm like, do I want this job? And he called me. He's like, nah, but have you heard about The Athletic? And I, honest to goodness, I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, Chris. What is it? And he's like, listen, call this guy. Call Craig Custance. He was at ESPN. He's going to Detroit. I call Craig. Craig's like, hey, I hear they're going to launch a couple other things. Let me hook you up with Alex. Okay. 2 days later, Alex calls me and says, hey, this is what we're thinking. We're going to head hopefully to Philly. You could fit there. We're thinking about a long form thing. You could fit there, but we're really excited about a college basketball site. And I'm already down the road with somebody, a national writer who, you know, I think you would like to work with. So I'm like, sign me up. I'm very interested. I hang up and I start, like, my brain starts turning, like, well, what national writer could he be thinking, talking about? So eventually I wormed my way around and figured it out that on my own that it was Seth. And I texted him and he's like, yeah, he's like, look, I was going to call you, but we're not there yet. So you put the cart before the horse. So, I mean, I like to think maybe Seth would have come to me eventually, probably, but he didn't have to because I got this wild back way, back door into the place.
Fortune favors the bold is what I would say.
maybe.
What kind of stories will you be doing at the Athletic? I've seen a couple, obviously. In the first couple of days, you broke a story about I think the referee's name is John Higgins, is suing Kentucky Sports Radio. It's actually a pretty interesting legal case about saying that he, because they were talking about his refereeing and sort of mocking him on the air, he got a ton of harassment and phone calls, et cetera. So that case is going to get into how much responsibility, if any, does a sports show or personality have in terms of other people per se maybe harassing as opposed to the people who are talking about the subject. But that was interesting. But as a general rule, do you have is there a sort of story that you'll be covering, and how does it work in terms of what your assignments are?
No, I mean, I don't think there's a sort of story. I think the general thinking of the Athletic is a little different. Their thing is like, look, I don't need 200 words every time, like, you know, LeVar Ball sneezes. So don't worry about panic-stricken 200 words that have to fly out the door. They really want us to take our time and find things that have some teeth, have some analysis, to really think things through, to report things out as best we can. So, you know, in terms of that, that could be a feature on a person. It could be a feature on a program, a coach, a trend. It could be an analysis. It's not to say I'm not going to go to a game. Of course, I'll go to games. But rather than write the traditional game story, which I frankly haven't written probably in 10 years anyway, it's going to be more of a extraction off of that game. What does this mean? Play it forward, that kind of thing. That's what they want us to do. They want us to think outside the box. You know, not in a weird way necessarily, but just think harder. Tell people things that they don't already know. They already know the score and who had 25 points. Tell them something different. So there's no limits to anything. And in terms of generating story ideas, I mean, there is no shortness. I mean, between, you know, myself and Seth and Brian Hamilton and Sam Vecini and C.L. Brown, I mean, we are just like shooting ideas to the point we're going to exhaust ourselves by November. And Seth is great. His thing is like, if you come up with something, you should own it because obviously you're passionate about it. So as best we can, if it's your idea, you're going to run with it. So, I mean, there's a list as long as my arm right now of things we'd like to tackle. I'm not saying we're going to get to them all, but, you know, I feel like it's the sky's the limit. And the cool thing is, you know, back in my ESPN days, and I don't discount this, you know, it was sort of like, well, that's not going to click. So you're not going to go write a story, no matter how great it would have to be, really, really great to move the needle, to be somebody that's like, you know, a MEAC school, for example. The argument at the Fieldhouse is we're the home for college basketball. So it might be somebody off a beaten path, but that's okay. We can still do that if the story's worth telling. So that's kind of exciting to me because I feel like sometimes we overlook stuff and people and stories because it's sort of like, well, nobody cares about them. Well, our job is to make them care. So that's kind of, I don't know. I'm excited about that part of it. So, yeah, I don't want to put myself in a pigeonhole myself at all because I don't know. I think it's pretty much whatever we kind of want to do, we can create.
Dana, how do you weigh this college basketball scandal in terms of how much the Fieldhouse should cover it versus, and I guess this is even a more interesting question, do you think it could have any larger ramifications about the popularity of the sport down the road?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, honestly, you know, people show up at baseball games through their crisis. They show up at football games through concussions. I don't think people are as naive as we think they are, and I don't envision this entire mass protest where I'm not going to show up for this game because they're paying players. I don't think that necessarily is going to occur. I still think the same thing will happen. People will go who are interested in the sport. So I don't know that that's going to change. In terms of us, it was funny, you know, it happened obviously last Tuesday. We don't publish till Monday, and we're all sort of like, well, what can we write that's going to hold? You know, everyone's going to pick up on this carcass like crazy for the next 6 days. So we had to sort of figure out where our space would be in terms of something interesting that hadn't been tackled already. And then going forward, I think it's like anything else. As things happen, you know, I think it's going to be exactly what I just said. It's not going to be 200 words on so-and-so got caught up in this or got fired or whatever. It's going to be something looking at what are the ramifications of those decisions. So I don't think we're shying away from it at all. I just think, you know, and we can go and investigate stuff, and we've already kicked around some other ideas of things that could be looked at off of it. But, you know, it's not going to be a 200-word minutia shove it at you every 5 minutes when something breaks. It's just, you know, people know what happens, right? I think our job is explain to it what it means. That's what we're trying to do.
Here's something that's always been interesting to me about your career from, I'm fairly certain we've never met. We've interacted mm-hmm. from afar, but one of the things at ESPN that always stood out to me about you was that I never basically saw you on television. You were truly a writer in terms of you reported on the sport, you wrote pieces, compelling work, but I didn't see you on Around the Horn or First Take mm-hmm. or Pardon the Interruption. I didn't really even see much on SportsCenter. And it always struck me that you at least came off to me as someone who was kind of like a grinder in the sense of that you were a writer first and foremost, mm-hmm. and you didn't, I'm using this in quotes here, you didn't want to be a personality, but maybe, mm-hmm. maybe there were reasons for that or something else, but I wanted to ask you just to sort of expound on that, because you did have a national profile, but unlike some of your other colleagues like Pat Forty, Andy Katz, et cetera, we really didn't see you much on television, and I wondered if there was a reason for that.
Yeah, I mean, I did, you know, certainly I did a few OTL appearances here and there when things came up, and I did a few SportsCenter hits as they needed. You know, I always felt like if you need me, I'm glad to do it. I'm glad to help. They even shoved me in a couple of sideline reporting things, which, you know, that was like a deer in the headlights times 50. You know, I won't say it was a conscious decision like or a refusal, but I got into this business many, 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 many years ago because I love to write. That is what makes me happy. It's my comfort zone. It's where my confidence lies. It's what intrigues me. It's what fires me up. Talking to people, writing that story is what I love about my job. I'm not, you know, an ostrich with my head in the sand and ignoring that the journalism has evolved. I understand you have to be versatile to do all of it. I'm not against it. I just never felt like it was my comfort zone. I don't have the confidence there. I'm Italian. I married the O'Neill thing, so I talk super fast. So I'm always worried that people aren't going to understand what in the world I said. So it was just more of a, if you need me, I'm glad to do it. But if you don't, I'm A-okay there. So I think maybe it was like I never pushed to do it. And when they asked, I was like, okay. But, I think my editors there will tell you I was a good foot soldier and I did it, but I wasn't like, you know, thrilled to do it. I wasn't begging to do it. I never really cared about that whole build your brand thing. I get it. I understand it. But I didn't get into this business to have X number of Twitter followers and have people tell me I'm wonderful. I got into this job because these happen to be the skill sets that when I put my head on the pillow at the end of the day and I want to get a paycheck and I tell my children all the time, do a job that makes you happy. This was it. This job makes me happy. That was my goal. So I don't really care if people know who I am and recognize me and all that nonsense. It never was important to me, so I never really pursued that stuff. So I'm happy to be an anonymous byline. When I was at the Philadelphia Daily News, we did as I called it, a poor man's sports reporter. It was called Daily News Live, and we would go in and sit around and talk for an hour and a half about Philly sports or whatever. And the first couple of times somebody recognized me, I was totally creeped out. I'm like, what? Why do you even care who I am? Like, what do you care? And I wasn't annoyed. I was just sort of like, really? Like, I'm just a stinking reporter. Like, why do you even care what is this about? So it's just not me, I guess is the best way to phrase it. It's just, I'm very happy to hide behind my byline.
Well, that's interesting and I appreciate that answer because that leads me into where I want to go now, and that's ESPN. Do you think that a lack of visibility on television had any impact at all when they made decisions about who they were laying off?
I mean, I say yes, and I could say yes in my circumstance, perhaps, but then I look at Ed Werder, and I look at Jason Stark, who was on TV plenty, and I look at somebody like Ashley Fox, who did like 95% TV, and,
right.
You know, and Andy Katz, I mean, that's all Andy did. So, you know, I don't think we can make that argument across the board, certainly. Did that impact the decision for me? Was I less valuable to them because of that? Perhaps. You know, I never asked for a reason, so I never got one because I didn't really think there was going to be one that satisfied me.
Right.
So why bother? So, you know, I think you can certainly make that argument for some people, but I don't think you can make that argument for everyone. Jay McManus was on TV. She did a radio show. You know, I'm not sure that there was a common denominator among the people that were let go.
Okay, I want to ask you about this, and you should go as far as you're comfortable on, but I think for people, you know, I think it's just interesting. For this particular audience, this is an interesting topic because obviously they're very well-versed in sports media, and you're a named person, and you were a named person who got laid off from the most famous brand or the biggest brand in the country. How did you find out that that ESPN was parting ways with you? Specifically, how does it work?
So, you know, that morning, there was a memo that went out from John Skipper. We all kind of, obviously everyone across the media world had heard that the layoffs were coming. The layoffs were coming. It was like freaking Paul Revere, right? Everyone knew they were coming. Nobody knew when. So there was a memo that went out that morning from John Skipper, essentially laying out, you know, all the nice platitudes that they were going to say. So everyone realized, okay, today is the day.
Right.
I had gone for a workout that morning, and I came home, and I was sitting at my kitchen counter eating my breakfast, and I was on Twitter just checking things out, kind of like what's going to happen, how's this going to fly. I think I had talked even to Jeff Goodman this morning, and where he was kind of like, I don't know, what's this going to be like, how are they going to let people know? We're like, I don't know, whatever. So I'm on Twitter, and I think I saw Ed Werder was let go, and I texted Pat Forty, because he and I are very good friends, and I just texted him like, wow, they let Werder go, I can't believe it. And literally, I think as soon as I hit send on that text, my phone rang, and it was an 860 area code. I'm like, well, I know what that means. So it was a phone call from an editor with an HR person in the office basically saying your contract is not going to be renewed. You're not going to write starting today. And then they went on to ask me about, okay, so we want to go over some details with you about HR. And I said, I stopped them. I said, no. I said, I can't even contemplate or comprehend a word that you're going to say beyond what you just said. So anything else you need to say to me is going to be in writing. I can't discuss anything further. And I hung up.
Wow.
And that was the end of the conversation. I was just too upset. I was like, okay, am I supposed to take notes on this? I'm like, write down, okay, this is what I'll do. I understand. Like, you know what? Just email me and then let me process what you just said to me and get back to me. So it wasn't like I wasn't trying to be mean, but I was just like, I am not in a position to comprehend anything like right now. Like, I don't know my left foot from my right. This has never happened to me before. So I'm going to allow myself to just sit here and be stunned for 10 minutes, if you don't mind. So that's basically how that went. And then, of course, I called my husband and texted some folks. And then the day started out. And as I said, at one point, it was like attending my own funeral. And the good part is it's nice to know people will show up and say nice things about me, I guess, because everyone's on Twitter saying something.
Yeah, I remember that day very, very well. Did you I understand that corporations have to have a certain protocol that they follow through human mm-hmm. resources. But what struck me, and I've talked to a lot of people at ESPN about how it went down for them. Obviously, people know I'm very close to Jay McManus. We teach together. We've been friends forever. Mm-hmm. Did you sense, Dana, that there was a coldness to this, given how, especially for someone like you, how long you had worked for that company and how many hours you had put in for them?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose you can make that argument. I will say, in defense of a couple of my editors, they called me immediately after and, you know, tried to talk to me. And I said, thank you. I appreciate you reaching out, but I'm not in a position to even have a conversation right now. So I will say the people I worked with directly, you know, attempted to be human about it. And I appreciated that at the time for sure. I mean, was it cold? Yes, but I don't know. Is there a warm, fuzzy way to say you're fired? I'm not really sure it would have made a difference that they called me and said, oh, I'm really sorry. I don't know, because
right.
The end result is the end result is the end result. So I'm not sure there's any way to couch it. And I'm, you know, I will say in defense of the people that had to make those phone calls, I'm sure it was not a fun day for them either. And to have to do that repeatedly, I mean, to call 100 people or however many you are in charge of calling, I don't take that task lightly. I am sure that that wasn't pleasant for them either. So, you know, it could have been handled better. I guess so, but I'm not really sure what would have made it soften the blow. A bottle of wine? I have no idea.
Probably not. How? What did they tell you about where you could work after the fact?
Well, of course, that was probably part of my fault because I was so, like I said, blindsided. I didn't really process a lot. So I waited till the next day and I called HR and I said, okay, so I just want to get my arms around some things. I'm going to try to do some freelancing. And they basically stopped me and they said, well, you can't. I'm like, wait, what? how am I supposed to get a job? Like, if I can't freelance, what do you mean? And they explained the no compete that we all signed. And I was, that probably made me more upset than the day before, because my thought was, okay, I got to get a job. I'm going to go freelance so I can keep my stuff out there. I can meet new editors. They can see my work and see if I'm worth hiring. So that really, I couldn't wrap my arms around that. How am I, and I kept saying, how am I supposed to, you know, get a job in a time? How am I supposed to do this? It turned out that, I mean, there was an end around that they came to eventually, where we all, you know, basically went on a case by case basis for approval. It was tedious, to say the least, but you know, I was able, there was a workaround at least. So, you know, you said that you present each case as they came up. I didn't, you know, want to kill myself doing 300,000 things anyway. It was summer. Basketball is quiet. And I couldn't write basketball anyway because it was part of the contract. It could be non-basketball. So, you know, it was frustrating. I won't lie, because I was just sort of, I felt like my hands were tied. But, you know, I think in that circumstance, I was fortunate that I'd been in this business for 25 years and I didn't need to necessarily go sell myself to a bunch of sports editors because they kind of knew who I was. If that weren't the case, I would feel really badly for people who aren't in those circumstances, right? Who don't have contacts, who don't know people. I'm sure it was very difficult. And I didn't have as much time on my contract, so it wasn't that bad. Friends of mine who have a very long time, it's a lot more complicated for them, you know, because you got to figure this out.
So basically, if I understand this correct, if people want to work in some other capacity that's not a quote unquote competitive thing, they have to go to ESPN and ask for permission on every job situation.
Yes.
Wow.
Pretty much.
That's yeah.
And I'll tell you what, I don't envy the HR people because they might be getting a lot of calls.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And so is it your understanding too that people, if they want to say they laid off, just for argument's sake, we'll say they laid off an NFL person. That NFL mm-hmm. person cannot work in the NFL unless they want to break that contract, right? Unless they want to cut their
I'm
contract
sure.
with ESPN, or is it individual as far as you know?
I think it's individual situations. I know some circumstances you had like a pre-existing relationship, like something you were doing, like a regular radio
right,
appearance,
right.
a regular podcast. You could certainly continue with that. So yeah, I you know, I can only speak from my own circumstances. That is basically like they didn't really want me writing basketball, not even like NBA draft stuff and everything else. I will say, you know, everything else that I asked for, they pretty much approved. You know, so it wasn't difficult basically in that regard. I mean, it was just a pain. Like I had to tell the editors, okay, I have a really good, you know, like what are the chicken or the egg question? Do I pitch a story to an editor? Or do I ask ESPN for permission first? Like if I pitch the story to the editor and the editor says yes, and then ESPN says no, well, that was a waste. But if I ask ESPN and the editor doesn't want it, well, that was a waste. So I'm fortunately, you know, I basically just did some freelancing with the Washington Post and a couple of like alumni magazine type things. So, you know, working with people that I just was honest with them. I said, this is a situation I'm in. So if you need me to do something and I'm not pitching to you, I'm going to have to get back to you. So just so you know where we stand. So yeah, it was a pain.
All right.
It was a pain.
Two more on this topic and then we'll,
yes, okay.
And then we'll move to college basketball, or more college basketball like stuff. How did you feel in the moments after you were laid off to see, and this happened fairly quickly, to see the drumbeat of press releases that ESPN PR had sent out on all the people that they had re-signed?
Well, I mean, I obviously knew what it was, right? I'm not stupid, because they've never done that before. It seemed very disingenuous to me and unnecessary. You know, I understand what they were trying to do to drum up good feelings or whatever. But, you know, it's just, the whole thing was just difficult. I mean, you know, there was a lot of gallows humor, a lot of conversations among the group of us that got laid off who were friends that, you know, I kept saying, I'm really proud of the group I got let go with. There's some really talented people here. Doesn't pay the bills, but hey, aren't we great? You know, I will say like early on, I got really aggravated and really wrapped up in it. And after a while, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to spend the rest of my career, you know, being angry at every little movie ESPN does and, you know, whatever. My goal is to go write really good stuff, and that will be that'll be my happy revenge. I don't need to like sit there and stew about every decision that they make. I mean, you know, I worked there for 9 years. Were they all, was every day perfect? No. Was every day at any place I've ever worked perfect? No. I had some really great opportunities. I did some really fun stories. Some people I still, you know, I have great feelings and great respect for quite a few writers that are still there. You know, it was a crappy business decision, in my opinion. And, you know, it's personal. I mean, it's funny. I've talked to basketball coaches about this. I said, you know, I'm going to have a hard time, short of a coach committing massive NCAA violations or being a complete and utter jackass, calling for someone to be fired, because I understand what that's all about now. Hmm. I know what that day's like. I had to sit my kids down and talk to my kids and tell them, you're going to be okay, don't worry, even though I didn't know that. And they had to watch me be sad and mad and all of those things and worry about what's going to happen. So I have a different perspective on it. And, you know, I just refuse to spend the rest of my time being angry about what happened. I'm just going to be happy about where it's led me, because I really feel like where I landed is a great place and a place I'm really excited to be. So, you know, I'm just going to let them be them. That's how where I stand on it, I guess.
Hey, guys, before we move on with our conversation, I wanted to remind you to take a listen to the hit podcast, Better Off. Jill Schlesinger, an Emmy-nominated business analyst and a senior CFP board ambassador, tackles uncomfortable and sometimes controversial money and investing issues without the financial jargon to get to the heart of what's important for everyone to know. Jill interviews guests like Jason Zweig, Nicole Lapin, and Michael Lewis to uncover surprising insights and provide actionable information so that you can make the most of your money. The best part of Jill's show? Jill takes listener phone calls every week to help unravel real-world financial issues. Search for Better Off wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's Better Off with Jill Schlesinger. Jill Schlesinger is an Emmy-nominated CBS News business analyst, a senior CFP board ambassador, and she tackles uncomfortable and sometimes controversial money and investing issues without the financial jargon to get to the heart of what's important for everyone to know. And now back to our conversation. All right, in terms of sort of segueing back here, there were a number of things when I put out there that you were going to be on this podcast that people were asking about. And it's interesting. And I think people are really fascinated by two things. Obviously, one, sort of what the ethics are in college basketball, and then two, interacting with coaches. So we'll sort of go with the coach part first. And that is how when you have written something that a coach doesn't particularly like, how have you handled that situation? And how often has that happened?
I mean, it happens, and it's interesting. Like, the best example I can give, one that comes right to my mind, a couple of, you know, when Jim Calhoun went through his NCAA issues, I wrote a column about him, and I compared him to Sergeant Schultz from Hogan Heroes. Like, see, I know nothing, and I see nothing, right. Whatever. Jim Calhoun did not care for that, at least he got the reference. And I saw him at Big East Media Day the next day, and he pulled me aside and said, you know, you didn't call me. And I said, you know what? You're right. I didn't. I probably should have, but I didn't. So we kind of hashed it out, and he wasn't happy with me. I had to do a goofy video that day, and I said, at the end of our conversation, I said, can we do the video? He said, sure. So I've always been like, if a coach is mad at me, he has the right to be mad at me, and if he's going to handle it professionally and take the time to call me, the least I can do is be a professional on the other end and take it. We don't have to agree. We can agree to disagree at the end, but I don't mind that. I think that they are perfectly in their right to say what they want to say. And hopefully, if we can talk it out and have a conversation as professionals, it doesn't necessarily ruin the relationship at the end. So I get it. I mean, hey, it's personal to them, too. And they have every right to call and yell at me. And I got to take those phone calls. You know, the people I get aggravated at are the ones that sit from afar and shoot lasers and never show up, or the coach doesn't even know them. That's not right. Like, you have to... You got to kind of stand in front of the firing squad if you're going to fire at them, I think. So I don't mind it. I don't mind it at all. I can't say I enjoy it, but I get it.
What, Dana, what have you found? You know, one of the things that's a little frustrating for me writing media about college sports is I find, and then I get yelled at by the college sports executives that I'm overgeneralizing. Maybe I am. I don't think I am, but it's this. I find so often that the analysts in both college basketball and college football really got up coaches more than any other analysts in other sports. And there's sort of like this, and maybe it has to do with college, and in certain places it's small towns, and the college football coach is the biggest thing going in that town. But a lot of times the broadcasts, I mean, listen, I like the guy personally, but Dick Vitale has done this for 30 years. It's and then to see him, and again, I like him a lot personally, but then to see him sort of just stunned by what's happened to Rick Pitino, is it's just a little hard to swallow. I mean, you built this guy up on Mount Olympus, and you know, you're part of the reason why there's, I think, the sort of God complex of coaches that they can do anything. Do you have you found over the years, particularly in college basketball, have you seen certainly at least on the broadcast side this what I've seen, or am I overgeneralizing and maybe there's a kind of a godding up of coaches in every sport?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think part of it is who are the analysts that were discussing their ex-coaches
right.
in a lot of situations, right? So it's sort of like taking a shot at one of your own. And there is that sort of like fraternity that you're just not going to do that. And I think it takes some nerve for coaches to call each other out, and they don't. And, you know, at least not publicly. So I think that's a lot of it. You know, I will say, look, I mean, I don't think Jay Billis is afraid to shoot from the hip as necessary. I think there are certainly plenty of people that are able to. But, you know, I mean, let's look. In the reason college coaches, especially in basketball, are treated in some regards the way they're, because they're the constant. I mean, you know, we need them. The kids change over hand over fist. You know, they're gone. I mean, I might have a great connection with a kid, and 6 months later, he's gone. You know, the coaches stick around. They're your sources if they want to be, or the assistant coaches are at least. And so you kind of, you know, I think people on TV, maybe even in print, have to pick their spots. I've said in the last week that I feel complicit in some of what has happened in this federal investigation, because I've heard the same rumors that everybody else has heard. I couldn't prove it, so you can't report it, but could I have dug harder on some of the things I saw? Maybe, I don't know. I certainly have tried in various circumstances to dig and see what I could turn up, but it's hard, really, really hard. So I think that's all part of it. You know, we're all human at some level, and we try to, you know, it's easier to kind of get along with people and get things with sugar, right? So you try to pick your spots. That doesn't mean, you know, I don't have a problem calling people out for their foibles. I don't think I do anyway. But I do think that that's a part of what gets wrapped up into all of this. Like, we, you know, you need the information at some level. So how far are you willing to push it?
How, as a general rule, how forthcoming do you find college basketball assistant coaches, either on the record or backgrounding, et cetera?
Well, I think, I mean, I've heard this from multiple people who cover both sports, that basketball, like compared to football, is like, you know, Candyland. And I have found assistant coaches and even head coaches are pretty forthcoming. Now, do they always, you know, I always am of the mindset, like when someone's telling me something, like, well, why are they telling me? Like, what's in it for them, right? There's got to be a spin to it. And I hate to sound like a cynic, but everyone's got their reference points and their reason for doing something. So I think you have to keep that information in the back of your head that there's probably a reason that this is being told to you. But I find them to be pretty forthcoming, some more than others. You know, I covered Jay Wright for 8 years at the Philadelphia Daily News, and he had I don't know what he's like now with this, but he had this rule with me when I would text him or hear something that he didn't want to confirm directly, but he didn't want to lie to me. He'd just write back underground. So I knew what that meant. That meant it's true, but I can't talk about it, and I can't tell you about it. Okay, I can make that work. And I think a lot of college basketball coaches work that way. I think, you know, we all know who the good ones are, who talk to you and tell you the truth and tell you stuff you need to know and don't, you know, don't actually flat out lie to you. So it's like any other profession. There are some that are less believable and trustworthy than others, and I think it's also a matter of how well they know you. I mean, like any other relationship, you're not going to go spill your guts to somebody you just met. That's why I always tell young reporters, if they're out covering a beat, especially if practice is open, even if you're not going to write, show up every stinking day to practice. So that coach sees you, you talk to them, don't open your notebook, just talk. I mean, the first time I ever went to Vegas in July for ESPN, I brought a notebook and didn't open it for 3 days. I just talked to people because I had covered Villanova and I knew some East Coast coaches. I didn't know all these big other coaches. I wanted to get to know them. I sat and talked to Roy Williams for 2 hours about golf. I do not play golf. But I was like, he'll get to know me this way. So I think that's all part of it.
Zach Miles, a listener, asked, what percentage of Division I teams do you think recruit unethically? And what is the most significant change you'd like to see made with recruiting?
Wow. I mean, I guess it's like it's sort of like, what do you tolerate as unethical? Is buying a kid a hamburger on the side unethical? Or is it just like complete academic fraud? I think there are some versions of, you know, quid pro quo going on with people. I don't know what the percentage is. 65? Because, I mean, that's not the mid-major level. I don't think that's occurring. So I'm talking about the bigger programs. Hmm. You know, 60, 65%. Not for every kid, not every day, but I think it's a lot. And again, I think it's, I don't know that it's $150,000 like we saw last week, but it might be something, you know, a little something here and there. And in terms of cleaning it up, I wish I knew the answer. I mean, people have talked about getting sneaker companies out. You know, I don't know, because I don't feel like the problem is just coaches anymore. I think it's parents. I'm flabbergasted at parents that pretty much prostitute their kids out. I can't, as a mom, I couldn't imagine. I think it's hangers-on and coaches. Everybody's got their hands out for these kids. So you cut off the coach's hand, well, but then the players' people still have their hands out. I think there just needs to be more, you know, honor among thieves, as I think was what the way Mike Bright put it to me the other day. You know, people have to be willing to not turn one another in, but call people out on the crap. I don't know how else you stop it.
Was that a dog cameo there, Dana, in the background?
Yeah, that was Murphy.
Murphy.
It's Murphy and Maisie.
Murphy and Maisie. Yeah. Oh, I like that. Murphy's very Irish sounding dog.
Yes, name. Murphy O'Neill, right?
Murphy O'Neill. Yeah, wow. Receiver. Murphy O'Neill is an unbelievable. It's like a dream. It's like I feel like I'm in Dublin at a bar listening to a band, Murphy O'Neill.
We're going to take him out on St. Patrick's Day and see how we do.
What player are you most looking forward to seeing this year and why?
I mean, I think the standard answer, and I'm not afraid to go with it either, is Miles Bridges. I just find it's so interesting to me that, you know, it's sad and it's awesome to me all at once that we're all excited that a kid chose to come back to college. I mean, it's like, oh my, we're like, you know, what a wonderful child that you came back to be a sophomore. But, you know, like, okay. But I think the jump that he could make and what he can do for Michigan State, I think is just going to be lights out. And, you know, I'm always anxious to see kids who have that year of maturity, because I do think it changes. I mean, that's not to say that Marvin Bagley is not more talented. Probably is, but I think a year of maturity changes the way a player handles college basketball. So I'm anxious to see if you can actually tell that in the production that he has this year.
All right, two more topics I want to get to. One is, how do you see the state of women in the college basketball media world? What in terms of sort of gender equality, in terms mm-hmm. of you seeing younger women in the business, both on the writing and broadcast side, how would you, I'll just leave it open-ended. Are things getting closer to, not maybe closer is not the right word, but are there more, have more women entered the business, I guess, since you started on for both print, broadcast, and digital?
Yeah, definitely. My mother's standard joke when I used to, when I was a young reporter, she would like see the games on TV and like would go down press row, like, you know, the backs of the people along press row and find me because I was the only one with long hair. So, you know, oh, that must be Dana because there's no other women there. And she wasn't far off from the truth. I, you know, it's certainly better, but I still go to the Final Four media room like there should be more. You know, it's myself, it's Nicole Auerbach, it's Nancy Armour, it's Shannon Ryan. I mean, the fact that I can name them is pretty sad. Ava Wallace, you know, there's not enough of them, in my opinion. Definitely getting better. I'm always encouraged when I go to talk to sports journalism classes and colleges. The number of women that are in the class, I find just thrilling. I went to Penn State with Kim Jones, who's now on the NFL Network, and Lori Shantz, who is now at the University of Oregon, but she was a reporter at many places before
that's
that.
Right.
They were both my peers, but we were like kind of it. So I'm encouraged to see that there's more of them. I do think, you know, there's a need. People want to hire women. But I don't know why there don't seem to be more kind of breaking through. a lot go to the TV route, and I get it. I don't look down, having tried to do sideline, I don't look down my nose at those people at all. I think they work really hard, and if you're good at it, you are exceptionally talented. So I don't see as many print people, but I think that's just the nature of the print beast. I mean, everyone's afraid to become a print journalist at this point in their lives. But it's better. It's definitely better. But there's still a lot of room to improve.
That's interesting, just because, like, I feel like the NBA, that's more of a on the broadcast side, but it's really getting good in terms of high profile people. Doris Burke, Kara Lawson, Sarah Kustak, Stephanie Reddy. You know, we're starting to see some like legitimate
Ramona,
of course, on the but then if I guess I'd have to sort of look, you know, team by team, especially on the print side, maybe it really is close to the pros, because off the top of my head, as I'm just sort of doing the math, most of the beat writers, I think, for the NBA, generally speaking, are still men, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, look, it's a situation, too. I mean, it's a female numbers crunch in college basketball, but there's also just a generic numbers crunch of who's actually covering college basketball anymore. There aren't that many people nationally, especially, covering the sport right now. So odds are there aren't that many women. You know, there are a few young beat writers that I've Lakin Littman is at in Indianapolis. She covers Notre Dame. She's terrific.
Yep.
So there are definitely, like I said, Ava Wallace at the Washington Post. There are some really good ones out there. But, you know, there's still, like I said, the fact that I can sit here and name them to meet you and then dry up of names tells me that there needs to be more.
Finally, you wrote a book on Villanova, their championship year. And you've obviously covered Jay Wright a long time. You have a really good relationship with him. There'll be people listening to this podcast who I think would want to write a book one day in sports, but they may end up having to cover that person after the book. So one of the things that's – and we've had a lot of people at my place, Tom Verducci and others, and they've been criticized sometimes for sort of writing a book on the subjects they've covered. How did you approach, and then also as a present-day proposition, how do you approach covering Jay Wright, having sort of embedded with that program to write a book on Villanova's championship?
Well, I mean, so my book was a little bit of an end around on that because, so I didn't actually like write it with Jay. Jay wrote his own book. So he, you know, really was limited in how much he could actually help me. Most of the reporting on that is reporting that I had done in my time at the Daily News as a beat reporter or with ESPN. And, you know, I had a few, and I certainly went back and interviewed a bunch of people that were associated with the program. So I felt like for me, I wasn't writing this book for Jay Wright. This was a reported book that I did based on my experiences.
Gotcha.
And I think also the most important thing is I put in the warts. You know, I put in the phone code scandal that they went through a few years ago and the NCAA investigation and when they stunk and they recruited kids that they probably shouldn't have and all the problems that they went through. So it wasn't by any means a soft touch on isn't Villanova wonderful. But, you know, I thought about it because obviously, look, part of I've known Jay for 20 years and people identify me with that program. And I don't mind it, but I don't necessarily like it because I'm sort of like, I don't want people to think like, you know, I'll never say anything negatively about Jay. I've been hard on him when necessary. I mean, but it's really hard to be a bit negative on the guy right now. He keeps winning. I mean, what am I supposed to do? But I would say going forward, I learned two things from reading that book. One is I could never, me personally, I could never be a person who flies in and just says, hi, nice to meet you person. I'm going to write a book about you. I could not have written that book if I hadn't lived it just because I think it just been so much work to sit there and try to dig and learn and report. I experienced a lot of that. And, you know, going forward, yeah, I think you do have to be careful. I mean, this book was about the program and the entire rise and fall and ebb and flow of the program. It wasn't just about one person. So I do think you have to be careful. I mean, we've seen those situations happen multiple times with people who write books. So, you know, I think it really has to be worth it. Your time, number one, and number two, like your comfort level and you're sure that you don't check your integrity at the door when you're doing it.
Dana O'Neill is a senior writer for The Athletic and specifically for The Fieldhouse, which is their college basketball site. Seth Davis is the... Does Seth have an actual former editor title or is it something else?
He's like the managing editor or the grand poobah, whatever you want to call him.
I mean, I will say power ultimately corrupts, Dana. Watch out for that guy. She's part of a staff with Brian Hamilton and some of the other people. It's like SI West basically now. That's The Athletic. She is mentioned. You can catch her work there. She just wrote a really interesting piece on John Higgins. And I think, Dana, as we're taping this, did you spend like a weekend with Penn State? You want to promote that piece?
I did. So I went up. So the Penn State football team has been riding these little blue school buses to the stadium for as long as anybody can remember. So I rode the bus with the team to a game a couple of weeks ago, and I kind of, rather than just write a story about, okay, I rode a bus with a football team, I used the route, because it's a kind of a circuitous route through no man's land to this glorious arrival at the stadium, to sort of set up the month of October for Penn State, because they've got Northwestern this weekend to bye, and then they're home against Michigan and at Ohio State. So it's either win and go to the playoffs or lose and call it a season. So, I sort of use the bus ride as a metaphor to explain where they are in this point of their season.
Nice. We'll check that out. Dana, I really respect your work, and I appreciate what you've done in this profession. Thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Dana O'Neill of The Athletic and obviously formerly of ESPN and the Philly Daily News. She's somebody I've really admired for a long time. She just consistently does quality work and someone who's a writer, first and foremost. As we mentioned at ESPN, you did see her occasionally on television, but she's a writer is what she is and what she does. And I respect that. So my thanks to her and I wish those guys the best of luck. On their, we've had a lot of athletic guests, Stu Mandel, Seth Davis, I should ask Lou, who else was from The Athletic? Tim Kawakami and some others. So James Myrtle. And so we are, I'm a fan of what they do, and I'm rooting for them to succeed for sure. So my thanks to Dana O'Neill. You can subscribe to this podcast. Head over to Apple Podcasts, the SI Media Podcast with Richard Deitch. Previous guest, last one, ESPN basketball analyst Doris Burke. We did a podcast with three independent journalists, Paul Kuharski, Greg Bedard, and Dejan Kovacevic. Hopefully I got that right. Evan Osnos of The New Yorker on his amazing piece reporting from North Korea, Kenny Main. And then we've done some roundtables as well with James Andrew Miller, John Oran, Andrew Buchholz. Please check out all the podcasts on Apple Podcasts as well as Google Play. My thanks to Cadence 13. My thanks to Sports Illustrated. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.